Questions? So last time we kind of discussed the road not taken. What we're going to talk about is few particle systems like atoms or nuclei or baryons like the proton, things that are made up out of a few things. There's a real important alternative where we have effectively an infinite number of particles and have translational symmetry. That is to say, where we have a lattice, so solids. What we saw through example was simplest possible example, delta functions. If we put together a variety of wave functions, then the overall wave function turned out to kind of look like a superposition of the individual wave functions modified by kind of a sine wave. And in fact, what Bloch proved is that if we had translational symmetry, which requires an infinite number of particles, then we would have a function that was exactly periodic on the lattice times this modulating factor. And that modulating factor, since it's just a phase factor, doesn't affect the charge density. It would factor out of psi star psi. So psi star psi is exactly periodic. The wave function, though, has this extra piece. Then there's kind of a tricky aspect to this, and that is we have the physical lattice with some separation distance a, and we have these k vectors. And it turns out that k is also periodic. So there's periodicity in the real lattice, and there's periodicity in k space. And you can see that. If you think about reducing k by a lattice spacing period, then what we've got left over is something that's exactly periodic. So this thing was only defined to be exactly periodic, which means that k is only defined up to this factor of 2 pi over the lattice spacing. Or in general, in three-dimensional space, there's going to be some finite-sized block, a Brillouin zone of k-space, which is really all we need in order to describe the particle. So we're going to have multiple bands in k-space for a typical three-dimensional solid. And it's worth kind of noting that if the bandwidth is small, so that is to say as you change k, the energy doesn't change very much, that'll happen if the atomic wave functions don't have much overlap, then there'll be a slow hopping frequency. That is to say, if you look at time-dependent wave functions and you put the electron on one of these particular nuclei, it'll take it a while before it hops to the next nuclei. It will with time, because the wave functions do go over the entire space. So that means if you think about the core electrons, they really don't have a lot of overlap with their neighbors, so they're going to form a very narrow band, not too much energy difference. And so they act as if they're localized, and you kind of might as well think about them being localized. But technically speaking, they do form a band. So we can make this big distinction between conductors, insulators, and semiconductors. So in conductors, this allowed region of these allowed wave functions of various k values and energy, it's only partially filled. So if you just give an electron epsilon more energy, there's an available state for it to go to. In the case of an insulator, we have exactly full band followed by another band. And so in order to get an electron to change its motion, we have to give it a finite, a noticeable amount of energy. Semiconductors are kind of in between, where the bands are close enough together that thermal energy can be enough to knock an electron into a previously unoccupied state. So when I say big, it's big compared to KT. So in terms of the kind of simple solid where we have no nuclei, we're just thinking about particles in a box, we can talk about a Fermi sphere and a Fermi energy that exactly divides the occupied-unoccupied space. Next semester, you'll do the thermodynamics and show that the occupation number, while it's basically 1 inside the Fermi sphere and it's basically 0 outside, there's actually a boundary region where the occupation number goes smoothly between 1 and 0 over a range that's roughly kt, where k is the Boltzmann constant. So the result is that an electron that's deep inside the Fermi sphere, it has no place to go, right? It would take a huge amount of energy to make it change its motion. So that's going to lead to long mean free paths. It can't scatter because there's no place to scatter to. And it also lead to small specific heats because the only electrons that can change their behavior are the ones that are near the surface. So these initially puzzling characteristics of metals are explained by this this requirement of anti-symmetry that follows from relativistic quantum mechanics. It should be maybe pointed out that while in fact these wave functions do have to span the whole molecular frame, it's not how the chemists look at things. So the chemists talk about a bond being a pair of shared electrons between the two nuclei, and they're wrong, but they have to be wrong in a way that's useful to them. That is to say, their point of view must answer useful chemical questions. And as long as the band frequency, as long as the bands are narrow enough, this idea of localized electrons is at least approximately true. Questions? So we could go, the quantum mechanics of solids is tremendously important. You might say it's the most important discovery of the last century, right? Because it led to electronics, which led to a computer-bred area, right? So famously, Bardeen, Broughton, and Shockley are the guys who invented the transistor at Bell Labs, AT&T's research center, circa 1950. And quantum mechanics is needed to explain all of that behavior. But it's kind of different quantum mechanics with these block states as opposed to the sort of states we're used to. So if you want to learn more about this sort of quantum mechanics, you have to take a different course, typically a course called solid state physics. Questions? Well, the plan today is to basically work a problem that I think I assigned in E&M, and it might have been a problem that was assigned in mechanics, and that is, how do we get magnetic fields into this picture? So, if you're trying to do something to an atom, kick it to see how it works, kind of the obvious thing to do is to put it in an electric or a magnetic field. So one of the early first things done is to try and figure out how these atomic energy levels changed when you put them in a magnetic field. When you put it in an electric field, it's pretty obvious, right? That's going to be a straightforward voltage, potential energy that's just going to be the charge times the voltage, and I guess we've done that for the point charge, but you could just add in a uniform electric field to that electric field and figure out how it works. Magnetic fields are a little bit tricky because they don't do work, so they don't have potential energies. Right? You know they don't do work because we know the Lorentz force law, and you know that work is force dotted with displacement, and the displacement has to be parallel to the velocity vector. And if you dot the velocity vector into V cross B, you get zero. So there isn't going to be literally a potential energy of magnetic fields. But obviously, I mean, we got to be able to solve the problems of particles in magnetic fields. So how exactly do we go about doing that? So if we flesh this out, right? So in general, from a 200 perspective, that would be the force law that we have to kind of make work. from a electricity and magnetism perspective, we know that the B field can be calculated as the curl of the vector potential. And the electric field approximately, not exactly correctly, can be written as the minus the gradient of the voltage. So, I don't know, how can we get that stuff in there? And I think a starting point is to kind of see how this all cranks out. So let's focus on the magnetic force. So what we have is a magnetic force that is Q V cross the curl of A. How does that work itself out? Well, you know that this gradient isn't literally a vector, but we can still kind of backcab it. So if we do that, it's going to be gradient of A dotted with V, right? So I don't know, I have kind of a notational problem. I want a sum over X, Y, and Z for those two guys, and I want the gradient to operate on A minus CAB, right? So that's going to be V dotted with grad giving the A vector. All of that times Q, which I guess I didn't write. So I don't know if you like it, but there is kind of a notational problem, and we all like Einstein's printer, so we all like Einstein's summation notation. So maybe we can get to the same place with Einstein's summation notation and see kind of what it looks like there. So you remember that if C is equal to A cross B, what this says is that the ith component of C is epsilon ijk ak, oops, aj bk, where the sum of the j's and the k's is assumed because they're written twice. There's only one I on the right hand side of that equation, so there's no sum on I. So let's use that trick and kind of do the same thing. So the force in the ith direction, overall factor of Q. So what I have is epsilon ijk of vj, and then I have the kth component of the curl. And the kth component of the curl can be written as epsilon k l m, say, of the derivative with respect to l a m. So lots of repeated indices, lots of sums. Let's focus on these pair of epsilons for a second. And remember that these epsilons are cyclically permeable. That is to say, I could write this just as well as epsilon LMK, moving the K to the back. Right? I can switch, as long as I keep them in a circular permutation, it has exactly the same value. So what I've got here is epsilon IJK, epsilon LMK, summed over K. And there's also a sum over J, L, and M, but let's worry just about the K to start with. So how could that be non-zero? Okay, so if K is, for example, 3, what values of I and J are going to be non-zero? Well, it has to be 1 and 2. And they're really just two options, right? Both of these could be 1 or 2, or one of them could be reversed. If they're both the same, whether out of order or in order, it's going to be a plus 1, right? Because minus 1 squared is plus 1. If one of them is out of order, then it's going to be a minus 1. So this sum is actually just epsilon I L delta J M minus the other way around. And that's exactly what the backcab rule is. So if we insert that, what we've got is Q times delta I L delta J M minus delta I M delta J L. And we have vj, derivative with respect to L, and am, all going along for the ride. So, for this first term, if we sum over j and m, this requires them to be the same. So if I sum over m, the only contribution I'm going to get is when m is equal to j. So this is going to give me, this term is going to give me, and similarly for L, it's going to give me vj derivative with respect to I, aj. I know. Looks a lot like that term, right? It is exactly the same as that term, just written in a way which is, I hope, unambiguous. And the other term is going to be where J and L are added together. So that's going to be VJ derivative with respect to J and then AI. And it's helpful to kind of notice where the where the remaining unsummed index is. But that's what we've got. Okay, so all of this is just Lorentz force law, and we're trying to write the Lorentz force law in terms of a Hamiltonian. How do we get to Hamiltonians? So the starting point for mechanics is Lagrangians. Right, so this is a Lagrangian, not an angular momentum. And the Lagrangian, roughly speaking, was the kinetic energy minus the potential energy. And Lagrange's equations were that the time derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities was equal to the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the coordinates. Okay, so I'm going to propose a Lagrangian that the Lagrange equation is Newton's equation. So hope for the best. So the Lagrangian I'm going to use is obviously kinetic energy, obviously potential energy, right? Charge times voltage. But then I'm going to add this extra term, of A dot V. And what I need to show is that that's going to give me these equations that we learned in 200, except now we're going to be doing them in terms of mechanics. Okay, so I make no justification about this. I'm just going to show that it works. Yeah, okay, so let's head to the races. So I have the time derivative of this with respect to the velocity. So this is going to give me mv plus qa, and those are both vectors. And this is going to equal minus q, the derivative, which is just say the gradient of phi. Well, I don't know if it's looking good or bad. Did I forget anything? Yes, I did forget something. So I also have this term here, right? That depends on position of the particle, so I've got that term too. So this is going to be plus q the, so this is where we start to have trouble writing things. So I'm going to write this as the derivative with respect to I of aj vj. And of course, the velocity doesn't depend on position, right? So this is going to be, could also be written as vj derivative with respect to I of aj. I don't know, which is looking a little bit like this term here that we're going to want. Okay, so most of our time is going to be spent in taking the time derivative of A, because A depends on position and it depends on time. So if I want to take the time derivative of A, I need to take, for example, the derivative of the A vector with respect to X and then multiply it by the derivative of x with respect to time. And similarly for y and z. So I have the derivative of z with respect to time, the derivative, partial derivative of z with respect to a. And of course, I also have the time derivative of a explicitly. So I don't know if you can see the dot product here. This is the velocity dotted into the gradient of a. Looks a little bit like this term here. Okay, so taking the derivative of velocity is easy. That's just going to give us acceleration. Let me put this term to the other side of the equation, so I get minus q grad phi, and here I've got plus q vj I aj, and now I've got minus vj grad ai. Oh, and I also have minus q times the time derivative of a, right? Okay, so we have seen this thing is exactly q v cross b. That's looking good. And this kind of looks like the electric field. Remember I said the electric field is mostly that, because that's what you're very used to from 200. But if you look carefully at what we did at the end of ENM, we said that if there was time dependence to the A vector, then in fact there was that term too, basically an induction term that needed to be added to the electric field. Okay, so I claim what I've shown is that that Lagrangian works. It puts the Lorentz force into Lagrange's equation. Okay, well, how do we go from Lagrange's to Hamiltonians? I guess you didn't do this in mechanics. I was told last semester. Is that true?
Kind of did it.
So the Hamiltonian is P Q dot minus the Lagrangian. Okay, so what's P? I probably shouldn't have erased something. So P is exactly defined to be that. It's not MV. It's, at least it's not in general MV. So this was called the canonical momentum. In contrast to the mechanical momentum, the mechanical momentum was momentum as in 191, mass times velocity. And I've kind of erased what this was, but so P, which was the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities, that was mv plus qa. And if you want, you can think of this as the canonical momentum is the mechanical momentum plus the electromagnetic momentum. It isn't exactly that way, but it's close enough at least to work as a mnemonic. Okay, so let me remind you that part of the game of Hamiltonian was once we have written out the Hamiltonian, we're going to get rid of the Q dots in favor of momentum. So this Hamiltonian is supposed to be just a function of P and Q. No more Q dots in it. And then Hamilton's equations are that the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the momentum is equal to Q dot, and minus the derivative with respect to the coordinate of the Hamiltonian is equal to P dot. And in mechanics, I'm going to assume, true or not, that you showed that these equations follow from Lagrange's equations. I'm not going to reprove Hamiltonian mechanics. And it's also worth reminding you that basically the Hamiltonian was the energy. It's not exactly the energy under kind of weird conditions, but under almost any normal conditions, the Hamiltonian is equal to the energy. Okay, so off to the races. So what we have is P, and then we're supposed to substitute in what Q dot is in terms of P. Q dot, of course, is the velocity, right? The generic version of the coordinate. So what we're going to get is P minus QA divided by M. Then we've got minus the Lagrangian, so we have minus 1/2 M P minus QA divided by M squared. And then we've got minus a minus, which is plus the voltage. And then we've got minus QA dot V. Okay, so let me bring back for a second that this is velocity, because then I can bring these two terms together. Right? So if I do that, then I have P minus QA. When I bring together these two terms dotted with velocity, and then let me substitute in that the velocity is in fact P minus QA divided by M. So I have a full one here and I subtract half a one there. So what I have is 1 over 2M P minus QA squared plus the voltage. Okay, so that's all she wrote. So in order to put magnetic fields into our Hamiltonian, all we have to do is add in this term. P is just like what it always is. It's H bar over I gradient. So before, you might have thought that P was MV, but P has actually always been the canonical momentum. It's just that in every case we've worked, the canonical momentum was the mechanical momentum. And why P is the mechanical, why this formula gives you the canonical momentum and not the mechanical momentum is a topic I don't think I'll take up. Can be shown. Okay. Gauge transformations. So gauge transformation had to do with the fact that the potentials, well, let me phrase it this way. Different potentials give you exactly the same physical fields, and it's only the physical fields that matter. So we could write different formulas for the voltage. It was kind of trivial. We could add a constant to the voltage and it wouldn't change the electric field. But for the vector potential, there was a greater freedom. We could take A and we could add to A the gradient of any function, and it'll give you, because the curl of the gradient is zero, it'll give you exactly the same magnetic field as the as you had with the original version. Now, if we actually had time-dependent potentials, then we would also have to have that gauge transformation for the voltage. I think I have that sign right. I guess it's plus. Well, it seems like it wants to be minus. It doesn't matter. We're not really thinking about time-dependent gauge transformations. So how is this going to change psi? If I change what I'm using for A, A has changed, and that's going to change Hamilton's equations, but nothing really should change. That is to say, the energy levels, the particle density, none of that thing should change just because I decided on a different mathematical formula for A, because nothing physically changed. So what we need is to know how the vector potential is going to change, or excuse me, how the wave function is going to change. And if we change the wave function by e to the I qf divided by h bar, then when we take the gradient of this term, right, so remember that we're going to take h bar over I times the gradient, we're going to generate, yes, we're going to generate a term that is exactly going to cancel what we got from A. Okay, so with this transformation, this quantity, sometimes called the covariant derivative, is invariant. So we're going to get exactly the same energies out of our wave function using our gauge transformed A. And obviously, the particle density doesn't change because that's just a pure phase factor. So at this point, several Nobel Prizes stand pregnant, waiting to be won. We know how electricity and magnetism works in 1960. But we don't know how the strong force works and the weak force works. And about the simplest guess you could make is that those forces work like light, except a little bit different. So how can we make something that's like light, but a little bit different? Well, one big hint is the delta plus plus. So you remember that delta plus plus was an excited state of a proton, and what this consists of is three up quarks, each one of which has a charge of plus 2/3, so you add it up, you get two positive charges. So I don't know, this has a mass that's 50% more than the mass of a proton, and it has spin 1/2, or excuse me, it has spin 3/2. And the quarks are spin 1/2. So if it has spin 3/2, the spin state must be a symmetric state. And that means that the spatial state has to be an anti-symmetric state, right? Because for fermions, the overall state has to be anti-symmetric. But we can't put those quarks in the same wave function, the ground state, and have them be totally anti-symmetric. Right? You could only make an anti-symmetric combination if you use two different wave functions, right? Because if you use the same wave function and subtract them, you get zero. So that means that these quarks can't actually all be the same. So apparently there are three different types of up quarks. And if you think about it, one way of doing that would be to have different, not electric charges, but if there's going to be a strong force, there has to be something that's equivalent to charge, but it has to do with the force, the strong force, as opposed to the electric force. So there must be three different charged, a logical guess, a Nobel Prize winning guess, is to think that there must be three independent charges, and These guys have different charges. So something that we have three of is the primary colors. So traditionally those charges are called, you can choose your favorite primary colors. I'm going to choose red, green, and blue. It has obviously nothing to do with physical color, it's just different types of charges. And just as red, green, and blue add up to white, these charges better add up to zero because there's no long-range strong force from the delta plus plus. So if charge is really three-dimensional, what I really need is a three-dimensional version of the A field, and I need a three-dimensional version of the size. So basically, this F needs to go do a 3x3 matrix. Well, we won't go there, but suffice it to say that the strong force really is just like electricity and magnetism, except there's a threeness to the charge, as opposed to having charges that you could put real numbers on. So maybe I should stress that those red, green, and blue, they can't be like plus, minus, and something like that. They actually have to be two-dimensional. They have to be in different directions that vector add up to zero, as opposed to just numerically add up to zero. So if you carry all that through, you get SU3 color, the nature of the strong force. If you go the other way and you try and make a weak force, you have kind of the opposite problem. One characteristic of the photon that you don't want in the weak force is that it has zero mass, right? Photons travel at the speed of light, they have zero mass. And we knew in 1960 that whatever it was that was carrying the weak force had to have a big mass because it was such a short-ranged force. So there, the kind of different project is how you could make something that was massless, kind of in terms of the mathematics, but practically had a mass. And that led to the Higgs field, the way of giving massless particles actual mass, which was then generalized to every particle. But the reason for its existence was to give mass to the photon version of the electromagnetic field. So all the forces except gravity, which is to say all the forces we understand at the quantum level, really stem from this basic idea of a gauge transformation, this idea of a covariant derivative, and this idea about how the wave function changes when you make a gauge transformation. Okay, so much for Nobel Prizes that weren't won. How about to more practical things? So let's do an example. About the simplest example you can think of is an electron that's moving in a uniform magnetic field. So this is usually called cyclotron motion. Because that's how cyclotrons were originally created, electrons going at high speed in a uniform magnetic field. If we kind of do the classical mechanics of it, I'm going to think about Q being a positive particle, but typically these things are electrons. If the particle is going to rotate this way, V cross B will be a centripetal force, so I'm going to have QVB, that's the force, equal to mv squared over r. And then we've got, I don't know, your favorite formula from 370 lab, that the momentum, we'll write it in terms of the momentum, is qbr. So the more momentum, the more radius, the more kinetic energy. Right? So the kinetic energy is mv squared. So what we've got is qvb r divided by 2. So more radius, more resulting kinetic energy of our rotating particle. The frequency of rotation. So the period of rotation we can calculate as the distance divided by the velocity. The frequency is 1 over the period, and usually we really care about 2 pi times the frequency, which we usually call omega. So if we plug or chug our way through this, this is the velocity over r, and the velocity over r was just qb over m. Right, from this equation here. So this is sometimes called the cyclotron frequency. There's another frequency that looks a whole lot like the cyclotron frequency, so you can confuse it easily, the Larmor frequency. Approximately speaking, the Larmor frequency is qb over 2m. Okay, so much for 200, 191. Let's do it in terms of quantum mechanics. So the first thing we're going to need is an A field that makes a uniform magnetic field, say in the Z direction. And I don't know, this is a problem we worked last time. Oops. I think I want a minus sign there. That's an A field that works. I think we can check it out. So if I take the curl of this, so 0, 0, 0, 0. So in the k direction, I've got minus the derivative of y, and then I've got plus this derivative, which is another minus 1. So split it in half, bring out the minus sign, multiply it by b0, and I get a pretty good version of the A field. There's kind of a quick and dirty way of writing this. This is minus b0 over 2 r cross z hat, I think. So so in terms of r cross b hat, I get y from this term, and I get minus x from that term, and with that minus sign, everything works out. So one important characteristic of this choice, right, there are lots of different formulas for A that produce a uniform magnetic field. If you want another example, A is equal to minus B naught just y. You can take the curl of that, and that also gives you a uniform magnetic field in the z direction. One nice characteristic, for that matter, of both of these is we occasionally made proofs assuming in E&M assuming that the divergence of A was equal to 0. It doesn't have to be 0, but for both of these cases, it is 0. I was about to say that's neither here nor there. What it is important is that now the gradient is related to the momentum operator. So that means that the momentum operator is going to commute with A, right? If I take the momentum dotted into A, I'm going to get 0 anyway. Okay, so off to town with our Hamiltonian. Right, here's our Hamiltonian. no voltage, so my Hamiltonian is just that. So I've got that as my equation. And let's bring out the square, right? So this is going to be p squared over 2m. That's our usual Laplacian. And then we're going to have, from the dot product, we're going to have minus q over m. And I'm going to write this as a dot p because it doesn't matter what order I write it on, right? Because they commute, because the divergence of a is equal to 0. And then I'm going to have plus q squared over 2m times a squared. And what's a squared? Well, there's a. It's easy to square it, right? So it's b naught squared divided by 4 x squared plus y squared. Simple harmonic oscillator. Let's take a look at this term. So A dotted with P. And so, well, let's write the whole term out, including the minus sign, I think. So what we've got then is minus a minus is plus. So we have QB divided by 2M R cross Z hat dotted into the momentum. Okay, so you remember the properties of these cross products. For the cost of a minus sign, I can reverse the order of that cross product. And for the cost of nothing at all, I can change the cross and the dot. So this is equal to minus QB over 2M Z hat dotted with R cross P. And R cross P is just angular momentum in the Z direction. Well, when dotted with Z, it's going to be in the Z direction. Okay, so generically, the upshot of all of this is we have a term that is minus Q over 2M B dot L. We took our B in the Z direction, but could be in any old direction. And this, you might remember, that's the classical gyromagnetic ratio. The gyromagnetic ratio is the thing that converted angular momentum into magnetic dipole moment. So what this term really is it's B dotted into the magnetic dipole moment. Okay, so let's solve this Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian, if we rewrite it a little bit, so we have the derivatives with respect to x and y. We've got this term squared, and I'm going to write that term as 1 half m omega squared x squared plus y squared. And if you look at what that omega is, it's qb over 2m. It's the Larmor frequency, not the cyclotron frequency. So that might be a bad sign, because we want the motion to have the cyclotron motion frequency, but we seem to have come up with the Larmor frequency instead. Okay, well, let's hold our breaths. So then we have this angular momentum term, QB over 2M LZ. And that's it. Oh, we also have kinetic energy in the Z direction. And classically, of course, there could be it's a helical motion. There could be momentum in the z direction too. Okay, so this Hamiltonian separates into two pieces, right? A piece that just depends on z and a piece that just depends on x and y. And we know how to solve this Hamiltonian, right? Here the piece is going to be e to the I k times z with a corresponding energy in the z direction that is h bar squared k squared over 2m. Right? So we're going to use a product wave function. This is going to be the z piece. So now we need to solve this Hamiltonian. Well, we have solved this Hamiltonian. That's the simple harmonic oscillator in two dimensions. And for that one, we found that the energy was h bar omega 2nr plus the absolute value of the angular momentum plus 1. Well, the angular momentum in the z direction is an eigenfunction of those same equations that we have. Right? This guy here is going to produce a corresponding eigenvalue that is minus qb over 2m h bar, and I'm sorry for the degenerate notation, m, the angular momentum in the z direction as opposed to the mass. And this thing here, that's of course exactly what I've been calling, well, without the h bar, omega. So in fact, the total energy then is h bar omega 2nr plus the absolute value of m minus m plus 1. And if we want the full story, there could be some motion in the z direction too. So these are called Landau levels. Nobel Prize winning Russian physicist. And do you see the infinite degeneracy? So we've had n squared degeneracy for the hydrogen atom, but here there's an infinite degeneracy. Right? So if I figure out the energy for nr being 1 and m being 1 and m being 1, I'll get the same value if this is 2 or 3, right? Because they'll subtract. So if I were to make one of these diagrams of energy versus m, there are an infinite number of particles that have exactly the same energy. Is that weird or not? Well, there's one thing that's weird about the original problem, and that is the ground state could exist any place. So if you have a uniform magnetic field, you know, the electron will happily circle in a small orbit there, or there, or there, or there, or there, or there. They all have the same energy, but they're distinct orbits. So we really need an infinite degeneracy in order to represent that fact. One kind of interesting thing, you noticed that the classical motion was that way, right? Where the z-axis was out of the board. So the classical motion has angular momentum in the minus z direction. And if I have angular momentum in the minus z direction, then I do add energy with this formula. Right? Because if m is minus 1, then they're going to add as opposed to subtract. So for negative values of m, there are energy levels kind of like this. Negative m does give you more energy, whereas positive m doesn't give you more energy. And that corresponds to if we have more motion like this, then we have a bigger orbit, we have more kinetic energy. But that could occur any place. That's why we have the infinite degeneracy piece of it. Okay, so a new exact solution in three dimensions. Motion in a uniform magnetic field. It's basically simple harmonic motion in two dimensions plus translational symmetry. And it's also useful to note that we got the classical gyromagnetic ratio for free coming out. But it's also useful to remember that we call it classical because it's not the right answer, right? We want the quantum gyromagnetic ratio. Okay, so that's all that's necessary in order to get magnetic fields into your Hamiltonian. And Zeeman was, of course, the guy. I don't know if he did it experimentally. I guess I just don't know. The Zeeman effect is the name we give to looking at how energy levels change when we put an atom in a magnetic field.